If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
The Hargan women seemed to have it all.
We were blessed. My mom was amazing.
But detectives would soon discover...
Inside the house, there were the bodies of two women.
A story of betrayal you would struggle to believe if it wasn't true.
I am just praying to God, this is a sick joke.
From 48 Hours, this is Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings. Listen to Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings, wherever you get your podcasts.
There's a very nice little quote I got from an interview with somebody who knew him. Was very surprised when she went the first time to his house in Hampstead at how comfortable and bourgeois it was. And so she asked him, you know, how do you square this? He said, well, if you're going down with the ship, you might as well go down first class.
That was Richard J. Evans talking about the life of the historian Eric Holtzbourne.
Listening to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine. We're the UK's best-selling history magazine, available in print and several digital formats all over the world. Find out more at historyextra.com/subscribe or look out for us in your digital newsstand or app store.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast. I'm Rob Attar, the editor of BBC History Magazine. In today's episode, we're going to be talking about Eric Holtzbourne, the 20th century historian whose books became global bestsellers and continue to inform students today. Holtzbourne was perhaps equally well known for his strong Marxist beliefs, which shaped and were shaped by his own fascinating life story that took him from the rise of the Nazis in Germany to the post-war Soho jazz scene and beyond. Professor Richard J. Evans has just completed the first biography of Holtzbourne, and I met up with him in London recently to explore the life and work of one of the most important and also maybe most controversial historians of recent times. The book is called A Life in History, and I'd be interested to know, how far do you think his own life shaped the history he produced?
Well, he, of course, in his autobiography says that his life was shaped by the historical events through which he lived and the sort of larger forces of those times. But he also said that he was an intuitive historian. He didn't plan what he wrote. And one of the central arguments of my biography is that there's a kind of dovetailing of Eric's personal life and the subjects he wrote about. So his own particular situation also influenced his historical writing. And one very good example of that was in the 1940s, when he was a very committed communist in many ways. He wrote about the rise of organized labor, the rise of the working class and wage labor, the Industrial Revolution, which carried on until the early to mid-1950s. But in the mid-1950s, he broke with the Communist Party in Britain, and he started to move not in communist circles, but in the kind of bohemian world of Soho. And he got interested in writing about deviant and marginal people in history, not about the rise of the wage worker, but about millenarians, about bandits, about what he called primitive rebels. So there is a kind of dovetailing there, really, which I found really fascinating.
So as you've already alluded, his communism is a huge part of who he was and his history. Where does that begin for him? Is that all from his time in Germany when the Nazis were on the rise?
Fundamentally, yes. So he was born in 1917, coincidentally, of course, but it's nevertheless, it's the year of the Russian Revolution. And he grew up in Vienna, but his parents died when he was quite young, when he was respectively 12 and 14. And so he was looked after by an uncle and aunt who became his guardians in Berlin. And he was there in the early 1930s. And that's a time, of course, when the Weimar Republic's falling apart. And I've talked to quite a few other people who lived through that period as adolescents and young people. The choice in the high schools, the grammar schools in Germany, particularly in Berlin, was really between Nazism and communism. It's a time not unlike our own, but much more extreme, when the center, as it were, fell apart. And Eric couldn't possibly become a Nazi. For one thing, he was a British citizen. He was known as the English boy in the school. And for another, he was Jewish. And of course, the Nazis were extreme anti-Semites. So he gravitated towards the Communist Party. He was already, his parents were liberal, secular Jews. He'd already experienced in Vienna beginnings of a polarization of politics between left and right and sympathized with the left. And he became a communist in Berlin. He didn't actually join the party. He didn't join the party until he was in Cambridge in 1936. But he became intellectually and ideologically a Marxist. I would call him a communist of a small c, because neither in Berlin nor in London, where the family, his uncle and aunt and his sister and their child and Eric all left just as the Nazis are seizing power, largely because his uncle's business failed. It's somewhat coincidental that that's when the Nazis were coming to power in March 1933. They left for London. And it's in London that he really read himself into the Marxist classics. But he didn't join the Communist Party because in Berlin, the Communist Party was a major force. In Germany in the early 30s, it had 100 deputies in the Reichstag, the national parliament. It could put 100,000 people onto the streets in a demonstration at a moment's notice. And in fact, he took part in the last great communist demonstration in Berlin before the Nazi seizure of power, early in 1933. And he got to England, and there wasn't a single communist MP. The Communist Party was a tiny sect, very little importance, and he just thought it was rather pathetic. And of course, he had to concentrate on his studies. I mean, he was brought up bilingually. His mother was a translator from English into German, and his school reports show that he was registered as bilingual English and German. But he still had to cope with a completely different educational system, with a new school, and he focused very much on his exams and then getting into Cambridge. So political activity took very much a back seat. But if there was any, it was for the Labour Party. So he did some canvassing for the Labour Party in the mid-30s. And again, that stuck in 1945. He thought it was the only serious political force on the left, despite his ideological commitment to communism. He never did any of the things that communists are supposed to do, only write for communist journals, sell the Daily Worker on the street corner, all of those kinds of things. So he was not a very good communist in the party sense, but ideologically he was very much a Marxist, a Marxist-Leninist, you can say.
Despite this passion for communism and for politics, why did he then decide not to pursue that as a career but to become a historian?
Well, he says in his memoirs that he felt he was going to be a historian from very early on. But I think that's sort of reading back into his past, something that was much less certain. So he certainly proved to be very good at history at school, and he read history at Cambridge from 1936 to 39. And he came to history from Marxism. In Cambridge, he encountered, through the economic history professor Munir Postan, who was a continental European in origin, and knew and prized the Annales school of French social and economic historians. He was introduced to all of that, and that was, as much of an influence on his thinking about history as Marxism was. And he got married during the war. He spent the war in Britain. He was by that time under MI5 surveillance, and they wouldn't let him out of the country. I thought they'd rather keep him at home where they could keep eyes on him. But he got married, and he felt he had to earn a living. He got a double starred first at Cambridge, so a starred first, top first in both parts of the historical tripos, the examination system. And that entitled you in those days automatically to a PhD studentship, which he had at King's College. But he also became a lecturer at Birkbeck in London, 1947. His wife worked as a civil servant, a fairly senior civil servant, but he certainly needed the money. The two of them needed the money, so he got this job as a history lecturer. He previously thought of becoming a poet, but I read some of his poems from the war, and they are truly terrible. I actually sent them to a colleague who was a professor of German poetry, and she wrote back and said it's a good job he became a historian. He was really a brilliant prose writer, but he couldn't manage the kind of concentration style you need for poetry. And he thought he might be a broadcaster. He applied to the BBC for a full-time job, but they turned him down. He even considered working for the Daily Mail, but in the end thought better of it. Though he canvassed a lot of kind of different things, including working as a propagandist for the communists. But I think in the end he was unwilling to give up his independence of mind. And so he plumped for history because he knew he was good at it, and he found it fascinating in many, many, many ways. But that decision only came really at the end of the Second World War.
Now, you mentioned in your last answer that MI5 had him on their radar. What was it about him that they deemed to be dangerous, and was that a realistic view of theirs?
Well, the two things that drew him to their attention. One was he was corresponding with some German exiled communists, an Austrian exiled communist, and that MI5 found that out, and so they began to be interested in him. And then after a fairly disastrous period in the Royal Engineers, because he was hopelessly impractical, he then got transferred to the Army Educational Corps. And one of his jobs was to put up wall newspapers. It's quite a widespread thing during the war to inform the troops. And they were arguing for a second front. Now, one of Stalin's demands was that the Allies, the British and the French, and then the Americans, should relieve the pressure on the Soviet armies and the Eastern Front by invading Western Europe. And the Allies felt it was too soon. They needed to prepare properly for it. And Erich's partisanship there was felt to be politically inconvenient because the Allies' authority did not want that kind of... They didn't want popular pressure put on them when they weren't ready. And so he was reported to MI5, and they started their files on him. I think he sort of suspected that somebody was kind of spying on him, but he never really found out until a good deal later that it was MI5. I think he thought it was the military authorities. And then after the war, then he became more active in the communist movement. As I say, not in a conventional way, but he did play a role in various friendship organizations, sort of British East German, British Czech, and so on, with communist regimes in Eastern Europe to get support from them. Didn't last very long, particularly I think it stopped in the early 50s when they became much more heavily Stalinized than they were before in these Eastern European countries. I don't think once they'd started opening his post for a while, and of course they had a listening device in the Communist Party headquarters in London, and so some of his conversations he had there, he very occasionally visited them, and sometimes phone conversations were recorded, monitored, and transcribed. And I don't think that they felt that once they got him on his radar that they should stop. But he was really pretty harmless, I think. He was a communist intellectual, as I say, with a small c. And all the time that they had him under surveillance, Until they were exposed, the famous Cambridge spies, who were a slightly older generation than he was, Burgess, Filby, Maclean, Blunt, they were literally getting away with murder. And I think it's because he wasn't quite British sort of thing. He was half Austrian. He spoke with a little bit of an accent, not much. He had all these continental connections. He wasn't a sort of classic, English public schoolboy from a good background like the real Cambridge spies were. Hugh Trevor Roper, who was involved in British intelligence during the war, wrote a devastating indictment on the Filby affair of the snobbish attitude of the Secret Services. You know, if you came with the right background, you could get away with almost anything.
So he becomes a historian and he's a Marxist historian. What exactly does that entail for a historian? I mean, I know what a Marxist is politically, but what does it mean to be a Marxist historian? How does that shape your work?
Well, he was never just a Marxist historian. He wrote about the rise of the manual labouring industrial class. He wrote about the Industrial Revolution. It gave him a perspective. It gave him the intellectual tools with which to interpret modern history. He wasn't actually, strictly speaking, an economic historian. As he said, he only became an economic historian by title, as it were, because that was the one area you could use Marxist concepts and methods, linking the economy and society, culture and politics at a time in the 50s when the vast majority of mainstream historians just did political and diplomatic history. Being a Marxist historian meant that you interpreted everything as coming directly or more usually indirectly from the economic base. So there was a conventional distinction between the base and the superstructure. Of course, it was more complicated than that. They had sort of mutual feedback loops and so on. If you look at his books, the age of books, they always start with the economy and then they move on to other areas. But it's in moving on to other areas that he broke free of the constraints of Marxism and incorporated the methods and the breadth of vision of the Annales school in France. So you'll find a lot of stuff in his book right from the very beginning, including in his book, The Rise of the Wage Worker, which he was unable to publish because it was turned down for being too Marxist. But even there, he has a wonderful section on working class culture, for example. And he also had the good fortune to be commissioned by George Weidenfeld, another Austrian Jewish exile, a publishing impresario without peer, I think, in the 50s and 60s, to write The Age of Revolution as part of this huge 40-volume history of civilization. And there again, it was a history of civilization. So Weidenfeld wanted him from the start to take an extremely broad view and write about art and music and science and learning and many different aspects of culture and society, as well as about politics and the economy. So his books are always very, very broad in that sense. But the Marxism comes through in a kind of amalgam with that much broader vision. So when he's writing Primitive Rebels or Bandits about these marginal figures, mostly in 19th century and early 20th century Europe, figures absolutely on the margin of society, but you can see the sort of sympathy coming through in the way he writes about them at a time when he was living a lot of his time in Soho and mixing with people on the margins of society in the Downbeat Club and other jazz venues he used to frequent. But he calls them primitive rebels, and that's because in his Marxist conceptualization of rebellion and resistance, they're primitive because they haven't become part of an organized political movement or the socialist movement or trade unions, in other words. So he has this kind of teleology, you know, that this, the advanced rebels are the ones who are essentially members of the socialist and communist parties. But he had this fascination with these figures who didn't get there, as it were. It's on the face of it, rather a patronizing attitude towards them, but at the same time, you can see he's very sympathetic.
Was it really his writings and his books, particularly the Age of series, that sort of took him beyond just being a regular historian, actually made him a real figure of note in the country and in the world?
Well, I think it's part and parcel of his Marxism, or you might say his Marxism is part and parcel of a wider, broader ability he had to develop new concepts and new methods and to pose challenging big questions. And illustrate them and explain them with a lot of wonderful references, anecdotes, quotations, all kinds of wonderful detail. So his influence on the historical profession, particularly on my generation, when we grew up as historians in the late 60s and 70s, under the influence of Eric Hobsbawm, Mabel Thompson, Rodney Hilter, Christopher Hill, and so on, was that he was able to develop these challenging concepts. So if you think of the idea of the general crisis of the 17th century, which he coined and he developed that in two long articles in the journal that he and others founded as an offshoot of the Communist Party Historians Group, past and present, in the early 50s. And he argued that if you looked right across Europe, from the English Civil Wars to France, Germany, 30 Years' War, and so on, there is a general crisis of the feudal economy and feudal society that causes these massive disruptions and conflicts and brings about change. And that sparked a very long debate, which drew in huge numbers of 17th century specialists and is still kind of rumbling on today, or the invention of tradition. Again, that you can see the Marxist influence on that, the idea that tradition is something that is not, it doesn't go back to time immemorial, but some traditions are actually invented. What sparked his interest there was, in fact, the service of nine lessons and carols at King's College, Cambridge, which he came across as an undergraduate, seemed traditional, but in fact, it was a very recent creation. We're celebrating its 100th anniversary this year. So there were plenty of others. He had this extraordinary ability to conceptualize and to order the historian's material. It's the most difficult thing a historian has to do is actually make sense of the inchoate, vast, sprawling mass of evidence and facts that we have to deal with. And the long 19th century, for example, 1789 to 1914 as a single overarching period. There are many other major concepts that he develops.
We don't always realise just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger. Talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Now, his books sold, many of them sold very well in Britain, but actually, he was often more popular overseas, and particularly in the book you highlight quite often how popular he was in, say, Brazil. So I wonder why you think it was that he was actually often more popular away from his home country than he was here in Britain.
Yes, I think he did have this British, English, really. He had a way with words. He approached history not just as an intellectual exercise, but also as a way of making the past come alive through literary style. He was a stylist. He was a writer in many ways before he was a historian, and he came to history, not just from Marxist theory, but from literature as well. He kept diaries as an adolescent, as a young man, and he has this truly terrifying weekly chronicle of his reading, which is sort of unimaginably vast and difficult books by the yard. And that includes not just Marxist classics, so he read all of those when he was a teenager, but also French drama, and he read French very well, long, lengthy novels in German, translation of War and Peace, and all kinds of literature, poetry. He went through one poet after another when he was a teenager, and that had a huge impact on his style. And that's quite unusual outside the UK. We do have this literary tradition of historical writing here that goes back to Macaulay and Gibbon and so on. And that stood us in very good stead as British historians making an impact abroad. And you can think of plenty of British historians who've had a huge success outside this country in translation. And he was certainly a pioneer there, I think, because his books are very readable, but they're also conceptually sophisticated and they make sense of long periods and difficult problems in history. That's combination, I think, which is not nearly so common in countries like Germany or even France, where the social science influence on history is much more powerful, I think. And then in this country, I think, to a degree, readers tend to be a bit suspicious of concepts and theories. That's much less so in the intellectual culture of many other countries.
With all the success that Hobsbawm gained in his career, he lived a comfortable life. He became something of an establishment figure. How did he himself square that with the fact that he was a man of the left? And does he need to? Does somebody who thinks the left-wing way have to live the lifestyle?
He went through periods of acute poverty when he was a child. He recalled, for example, how he had to go through the snow in Vienna in the winter in a pair of old shoes that let the water in. And he had he was given this old secondhand bike, and he was so ashamed of it when he got to Berlin. He took it to Berlin, and he was cycling to school when it's quite a well-off sort of district, part of Berlin, and the other kids had come along in their Mercedes and so on. And he got to school early so he could hide the bike away. And he's very conscious of a sort of economic insecurity. His parents and his uncle and aunt, who looked after him in Berlin and then in London, were essentially unsuccessful. His father was an unsuccessful businessman, so was his uncle. His mother made a bit of money from translating and writing novels, indeed, but not very much. And that never left him, that sense of economic insecurity. Even into old age, when he was earning a lot of money from his books. I don't think it's a question he asked himself very much. I think I get the sense he rather avoided saying, look, here I am, I'm a Marxist, but I'm making, hundreds of thousands of pounds from my books. I mean, he did make a good deal of money and was very well off, had a nice house in Hampstead, was able to afford foreign travel and so on. There's a very nice little quote I got from an interview with someone who knew him, who was very surprised when she went the first time to his house in Hampstead at how comfortable and bourgeois it was. And so she asked him, you know, how do you square this? He said, well, if you're going down with the ship, you might as well go down first class. So I think that, you know, that's it's quite a difficult aspect to deal with, I think, because he wasn't really conscious of this. But he felt that, I mean, he didn't live in sort of massive luxury. He wasn't hugely wealthy. He didn't have a yacht in the Caribbean or anything like that. He was comfortably off, I think.
Does this also point to some extent of his kind of independence? Because he doesn't seem to be, like you already mentioned, a classical Marxist. And he, for example, you note in the book, he was friends with someone like Neil Ferguson, for example, a man of the right.
Yeah.
Was he unusual in the sort of left-wing Marxist historian circles that he was quite happy to talk to people from other areas, draw ideas from them, engage with them?
Yeah, he would talk to anybody. I'm not sure he drew many ideas from the right. I mean, as a historian, he did recognise when Marxist theory didn't work. So in his book, The Age of Empire, for example, he recognises that the economic theories of imperialism is all driven by economic factors, what you get from Lenin or from Rosa Luxemburg, rather different arguments, that they didn't work. So when facts proved resistance to Marxist interpretation, he He let them triumph, as it were, in his writings. He would talk to anybody and get to know anybody. But there's also an aspect of him that I think enjoyed becoming part of the establishment, although not quite of it, but in it. So he loved belonging to the Athenaeum Club, that great establishment in Pall Mall, where there's said to be more bishops per square meter than anywhere else in the world outside the Vatican, for example, the very establishment institution, just like the British Academy. He was very proud of being a fellow of the British Academy. He had honours and awards, and he was invested with the Companionship of Honour, which is an equivalent to a knighthood. Although when Tony Blair, on whom he'd had quite a lot of influence, I think, by his writings about the Labour Party, recommended him for an honour. He gave him a choice of having a knighthood or a companionship of honour because he knew that his old comrades, as he told me, would never forgive him if he became Sir Eric Hobsbawm. He said, CH is for the awkward squad. He said, if Jack Jones, the trade union leader, is a CH, then I'd have no shame in doing that. But there's a sense in which he relished being part of the establishment. And, of course, that didn't turn him intellectually or politically to the right at all, but he liked that sense of acceptance.
In the book, you highlight examples of where he was criticised during his life and afterwards, sometimes quite savagely, for his communist beliefs. And I feel in the book you do mount quite a strong defence of him in many ways, but do you think he was still, to some extent, perhaps a little bit blind to some of the worst aspects of communism in practice?
It's not my job to defend him through the books. My job to tell the story of his life, to explain how he thought, why he did what he did, and how he became who he was, and so on, and let the reader judge. But I think it's my duty to give the reader a full set of materials and evidence and argument on which to base a judgment. And he came to communism in its most radical phase in the early 1930s. In the so-called third period, when Stalin was really in control of the international communist movement and arguing that social democrats, moderate labor people, were really betraying the working class. They were worse than the fascists and the Nazis because they were weakening the working class. It's only the mid-30s that the Popular Front came, and Stalin changed his mind when he saw how counterproductive this third period was. So Eric was politicised at a time before a lot of British communists were politicised, and in Berlin, where it was a matter of life and death. So for him, communism, the communist ideal, if you like, small c communism, was something that was part of his identity, and of course strengthened by the fact that he was an orphan. He didn't have a family, not a close family, and he, I think, experienced the communist movement as a kind of substitute family. There's a very interesting monitored telephone conversation by MI5 involving Eric, whether the communists basically start to threaten him with expulsion, and he sort of breaks down and says, "You can't do that. Please don't do that." Even though he's leading a campaign in 1956 against the British Communist Party leadership to become more democratic, to reform themselves, to admit they've made mistakes, to admit that Stalinism was wrong, all of these things. And so I think there's kind of war within him between this communist, small-c communist commitment on the one hand, and the recognition of the crimes of Stalin and Stalinism in particular. And I don't think the war was ever quite resolved. And it's one of the fascinating things about Age of Extremes, his history of the short 20th century, that you can see this. He's trying to come to terms with the evils of Stalinism. And it's quite a difficult thing, I think, for somebody who's been as committed as he has been through his life.
Now, you've already elaborated on some of the many strengths of Hobsbawm's writing, but what would you say were potentially the weaknesses? I know in the book you talk about perhaps his perspective on women wasn't as strong or comprehensive as it could have been.
Well, yes. I mean, that's putting it very, very gently. I think that was a weak spot. It's partly to do with his Marxism, because the fundamental belief of Marxism is that the problem of women's equality and women's rights will be resolved by the revolution. And so trying to fight for them beforehand is a diversion. It's making bourgeois capitalism more acceptable. And I think he never quite overcame that belief. I think he was influenced by the world of jazz. So after he, in effect, broke with the Communist Party after 1956, when his campaign to democratize it completely failed, he then sought refuge in the world of jazz, in the jazz community. And it was a very, very masculine, male chauvinist world in which the jazz players were all men, apart from the occasional female singer, in which, you know, men were cats and women were chicks, and they were seen rather sort of as appendages of the male jazz players. And that's the one world in which he moved as well. And then when you have the arrival of what's often called second wave feminism, to distinguish it from the suffragettes and that generation, in, I guess, the mid to late 70s, he found it very difficult to come to terms with. So that is a real weakness of his work. I think he stuck a chapter on women into the Age of Empire, whereas there weren't any in the Age of Revolution or the Age of Capital, the preceding volumes. You can see he was rather half-hearted. And, of course, one of the problems of his writings about wage workers in the Industrial Revolution, particularly the furious debate he unleashed on the standard of living in the Industrial Revolution, which is still going on many decades later, is it didn't take account of women workers. And yet there were, you know, look at textile factories, there they were in their tens of thousands. But for him, as for the traditional Marxist labor movement, it was the male breadwinner who was really the, it was the male who was the breadwinner, I should say, who was really the one who counted. So that's a weak spot. I think he had a bit of a weak spot in dealing with America, with the United States of America. He didn't understand America. He often says in his private writings, his letters in particular, which I quote, that he found it incomprehensible. He just couldn't come to terms with American society. And that also shows in his work, I think. He was what we'd nowadays call Eurocentric. I mean, you can justify that in the sense that his three great 19th century volumes are about the spread of the industrial, or spread of the influence of the industrial and French revolutions across the world. And they certainly start respectively in Britain and France. But when you get to the 20th century and Age of Extremes, I think there he divides it in his usual way, with wonderful clarity, between three different periods. But to call, you know, it runs from 1914 to 1989, and to call the central period of the 1950s a golden age is ignoring the massive amount of suffering, war, conflict, hunger, famine, and so on in Asia in particular. So I think it was quite a European perspective that he couldn't free himself from in that sense. And finally, I think one of the most remarkable things about his writing is its openness to culture. He writes a lot about culture at a time when historians didn't really do that. But it's very much the kind of culture he grew up with in Vienna, and to some extent Berlin, but above all in Vienna, it shaped his views. So he loved the great Viennese writers like Karl Kraus, or the composers like Mahler, and he wrote very movingly and very intelligently and well-informed way about the Jewish influence on 19th century Viennese culture. But he had a bit of a deaf ear, particularly to modern art and to pop music. He thought the Beatles wouldn't last, and he wrote about them in the 1960s. He was completely repelled by the folk music movement, which is a communist, actually supported the idea of folk music. It sprang from the people and so on. But he wasn't interested in folk music at all, and didn't really write about the hugely important part of music in popular life before the Industrial Revolution and the way it was transformed during the Industrial Revolution. So there's a number of gaps, a number of weak spots, that we all have these. And what's really striking about his writing is the incredible erudition, the vast range of reference and huge knowledge that he had about so many aspects of modern life, modern society and economy, culture, the arts, politics, and so on, and the way that he can link all these things together. And that is one of the strengths of the Marxist approach. You can link these different aspects of society, though then, of course, if you start looking more carefully, some of the links appear to be not quite as You can read them in other different ways. And I think in his early work, in Age of Revolution, for example, there are passages which you might call reductionist. In other words, he just sees politics as an expression of class interests and doesn't allow it enough autonomy. But that changes over time as he gets older and more experienced and more knowledgeable as a historian. And overall, I think he is a wonderful historical writer with a huge amount to offer.
Now, the historical profession does obviously move on and can move quite fast at times. But would you still say that Hobsbawm books are required reading for history students, historians in the 21st century?
Well, it's very remarkable that they're all still in print. So, I mean, the Age of Revolution, walk into any university bookshop, you can see it there on the history shelves. That was written in 1962. How many other historians whose books come from so long ago are still required reading on university history courses? As I say, the reason I think is because they have these challenging hypotheses, which you can discuss in a seminar. Quotable quotes, they're beautifully written, they're very absorbing, he can carry the reader forward. And that's a very rare combination. So I think he still has a direct influence on history students who read his work and I think should continue to read his work.
Unlike a lot of biographers, you've actually knew Eric and you met him several times. In terms of sort of your personal relationship, what kind of a man was he to meet or to encounter?
Well, I only knew him in his later years, of course, through Birkbeck, where I taught from 1989 to 1998, and then subsequently. And he was, of course, a lifelong lecturer, then reader and professor at Birkbeck, and became an honorary fellow. And we actually gave him an office in the history department and some resources and became president of the college. So that's how I got to know him, really. And I always felt somewhat in awe of him because I knew he was knew so much more than I did about anything we could talk about. But he was fascinating to talk to. And of course, he knew so many people and had all kinds of views, which was often quite surprising. You could never quite predict what he would think about things. He was, I think, an extraordinarily kind man. When I was appointed at Birkbeck, they gave me the job of rounding up the kind of PhD students and seeing what they were doing and so on. And they'd been rather neglected when I got there in 1989, I fear. In fact, when I did a mail shot, I got two letters back marked recipient deceased. And Eric got very worried. He came in to see me and started explaining that, this student and that student, they'd never finish, but they needed the psychological prop of thinking they were a PhD student and so on. So he was very kind in that sense. And as far as I can see, entirely without malice, he never indulged in malicious gossip of the sort that's unfortunately far too common in universities. He wasn't a good hater like too many historians are. He could be a savage reviewer, when he thought a book was badly put together or implausible, but he was never personal about it. It's striking that anybody who knew him speaks very warmly of him in so many ways, I think. He was an admirable man. He became rather Olympian in his later years. I remember him at the British Academy meeting, we're considering somebody for election, and he simply said, well, I've been reading his work for 35 years and I've never learned anything from it at all. Well, that was the end of him, But yeah, no, he was basically a very nice man.
And this is a tough question, but would you say that Hobsbawm was, for you at least, was he the greatest historian of the 20th century?
Well, I think there are many, it's very difficult. There are many different kinds of historians. I think he's very hard to beat for his combination of different kinds of history, analytical, narrative, even statistical. He wasn't, however, a great archival researcher. He didn't really do things of that kind. So you can point to other historians who have made major archival discoveries. His forte lay in, I think, synthesizing a huge mass of material and interpreting it and presenting it in a readable way. So he was that kind of historian. He wasn't a great narrative historian in the sense that his books tended to be thematic in their approach. So if you think of a book I've always admired greatly, Stephen Runciman's three-volume History of the Crusades, that is a kind of unbeatable narrative. You can think of historians who've done enormous amounts of work on editing documents, for example, producing editions of of documents and editions of works by the most minute, painstaking kind of scholarship, and that he wasn't that kind of historian either. I think it's once you get up to the kind of top ranks of historians, it's very difficult to say A is better than B, because we do so many different kinds of things.
I realise that Eric only died a few years ago, but things in the world have moved on quite a lot since then. I wonder, what do you think he would make of some of the major political developments of the last 3 or 4 years?
I think he'd be shocked and appalled, mostly. He was, anyway, fairly pessimistic, but he had a brief flaring of optimism when the crash of 2008 and thought capitalism was on the skids, and actually published a book of essays about capitalism, sort of explaining why Marx is relevant, become relevant again. But I think he would be appalled by the rise of populism across the world, particularly by racism and xenophobia, which you find now in so many parts of Europe and beyond Europe. He was a very cosmopolitan figure, a very tolerant figure. One of the things he most prized in the jazz community where he moved in the late 50s was its entire lack of racism, for example, or discrimination. So I think he would have been very depressed, and I don't think he would have approved of Brexit, though it's hard to guess because, as I say, he was often very unpredictable in his responses to current politics, and that's one of the ways in which he was ultimately far too independent a thinker to be a straight down the line Marxist or communist.
His anti-racism sort of cosmopolitan views, how much of that do you think stems from his Jewish background? Which I know wasn't necessarily, he wasn't religious, but that did mean quite a lot to him.
He was born into a Jewish, secular, thoroughly acculturated Viennese family. But at a time in the 1920s when there was a great deal of anti-Semitism in Vienna, it had been encouraged by the pre-war mayor of Vienna, Karl Lueger. And, of course, you have in the 30s the rise of Nazism. And not long before she died, his mother said, never do or be seen to do anything that will make you ashamed to be a Jew. And his Jewish identity was residual, I think, submerged, but it was always there. It comes out in various funny little ways through his career, really. He tended to avoid writing about Auschwitz and the Holocaust, although he lost relatives, people he knew very well, who were murdered by the Nazis, but he didn't like to confront it. He surprisingly, perhaps, and he certainly surprised many people he knew, for his funeral, he left instructions that a Jewish friend of his, very distinguished historian, American historian Ari Katznelson, should read the Kaddish, the Jewish prayer for the dead, at his funeral, which is quite a religious text. But he did feel these things. And it came out towards the end of his life also in these wonderful late essays on Viennese Jewish culture in the 19th century.
If someone's listening to this podcast and they're really enthused and they want to go and read a book by Eric Hobsbawm, I'm sure there are many great books by Hobsbawm, but if there were just one you'd suggest they start with, what would you say?
I'd say start with Bandits, really. It's a favourite book. It's absolutely favourite book of mine. It's a favourite book of his as well, along with Primitive Rebels, which is somewhat more academic treatment of these things. But it's so entertaining, it's so absorbing, and so thought-provoking as well. And it's short. So if you like it, you can go on to the longer books, Age of Revolution, for example. And then essays, of course. He was a great essayist. He wrote so many essays and so many articles as well. But start with Bandits.
That was Richard J. Evans. Eric Hobsbawm, A Life in History, has just been published in the UK by Little Brown. In the US, it's due to be published in April by Oxford University Press. And you can read a version of this interview in the February edition of BBC History magazine, which is on sale now, and also includes articles on the Viking invasion of England, the Holocaust, an American visitor to Victorian Britain, and Georgian killers who cheated the noose. You can get hold of our February edition in all good retailers in the UK and worldwide in our many digital formats. And that is about all for today, but do join us again on Thursday for more from the world of history.
Thanks for listening to this History Extra podcast. which was produced by Jack Fletcher. Do let us know what you think about this episode by emailing podcast@historyextra.com, and we might read out your messages in future editions. Alternatively, why not keep in touch via Twitter or Facebook, where you'll find us at History Extra. For more great history content, don't forget to visit our website, historyextra.com, which is full of history articles, quizzes, image galleries, and more. Plus, it's where you can download hundreds of previous episodes of this podcast.